January 25th meeting of Senate Resources to order. At the table, head table here, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Pascvant, Senator McGuire, Senator Frech, and Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator Wagoner. First order of business, not going to take very long out of our schedule today. We're going to bring Senate Bill 24 before us, and there were some questions asked by Fish and Game on, I'm getting some feedback here. Is there any way we can stop that? I'll just back up. We have some Fish and Game officials available to answer those questions. Al Kane is online, and Lisa Evans is here. Would you like to come up, Lisa, and join Mr. Pulaski here at the head table, and that way we can have everybody on mic? And with that, I think to start out, we'll have Mike Pulaski, who is aide to Senator McGuire, lead us off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Michael Pulaski, aide to Senator McGuire. Just quickly for the committee, the point of bringing Fish and Game Enforcement back before you today was to talk about the enforcement provisions within the current draft of Senate Bill 24, and in particular, Section 0857220 on page 13, which were the responsibility provisions. Both Senator Pascvant and Senator Stedman had asked specific questions about the tightness of this language and what it would mean to the enforcement side of it, and we asked Fish and Game to come before the committee and answer those questions.
Okay. So, can you hear me, Mr. Kane?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. You want to ask some specific questions, or you just want them to cover, want him to cover the provisions?
Mr. Chairman, the hope was to cover the provisions and to highlight differences between what 24 would do, exactly.
If you would proceed, then give us a rundown on those provisions.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure I understand. You want me to discuss the provisions of Section 220, the two provisions for making guides responsible for violations?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. The first section there on page 14 in Section 1 makes a guide responsible for a violation, actually a guide, an outfitter, or a transporter, responsible when a client commits a violation in their presence. And I don't see any culpable mental state stated there at all. Now, it's the provision under Section 200, which is the civil penalties in SB 24 that would come into play for that. So perhaps a real-world example would be a client is fishing and catches too many fish. The guide wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. He could be given civil penalties or sanctions under Section 200 by the Sport Fishing Guide Services Board for that kind of activity. If the troopers came on board the boat and found there were too many fish on board, the guide could be given that, but the guide could not be issued a citation for the same violation that the client had committed in those circumstances. Under Section 2, there is a requirement that the guide expressly or impliedly authorizes an unlawful act. And in that case, the bill language there does make the guide equally responsible for that violation. So if the client said, hey, I want to take home two extra king salmon, and the guide said, well, go ahead and catch them, and that occurred, the guide would be equally responsible and could be convicted of the same type of activity that the client was under Section 2 there, and could be sentenced under Section 210 of the bill, which are the criminal provisions in the penalty sections there.
Questions? Senator Stedman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think the concern was how do you tie the guide, or for that matter, the assistant guide, back to the outfitter. There seems to be occasions when the behavior of the guide is condoned by the people that own or manage particular lodges, and then they have the tendency of claiming that they're just hiring individual, contract workers, therefore not responsible. And so,
right. I don't see any provision under Section 210 in the bill that, now you said outfitter, I assume by that you mean the actual guide. Under current law, we have operators who employ guides, and those premises change in SB 24 to a guide who employs assistant guides. So in your question, I assume you mean how is the guide made responsible who's not on the boat, but is the employer of the assistant guide?
Correct.
Okay.
And the guide.
I don't see a provision here that allows for that connection. What I see under Section 210 at this time is a person who's licensed under the chapter who commits or aids in the commission of a violation or permits the client to commit a violation, and that type of language pretty much infers the guide or assistant guide who is out on the boat. This does not make the actual guide who's back at the lodge responsible, and we currently do have language in 1640260 that does make the operator essentially liable for inappropriate actions committed by the guides they employ. So at this time, I don't think SB 24 captures that element.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if that's in fact the case. It's on the, if there's some language already on the books, I'd suggest we take a look at that if we advance this bill, because I think that language is a little on the weak side, because there are some lodges that condone behaviors of, pretty egregious violations of our fish and game laws. And it's very difficult to go back up from the guided sport boat into the lodge owner when he's not on the boat.
Senator Passman. First, I'd like to recognize Senator Geisel, who's in the audience here. Go ahead, Senator Passman.
Following up on that, I know over the years that I've heard in the construction trades where you'll have the general contractor, for example, with the sheetrock workers, where he hires them not as employees, but the general contractor hires them as independent contractors. So you'll have 10 independent contractors out there where the general is supplying all the scaffolding, all the tools, all the everything for the trade, and these, quote, independent contractors are showing up and really behaving as if they're employees. The question is a lodge operator would use an artifice to create a mechanism to avoid a liability for egregious conduct, and I think that's what one of the focuses that's being thought about.
All right. I think, does that pretty well cover it? I think you're right. We need to look at that other language to see if we can incorporate that in there. There's a couple other items. Thank you, Mr. Kane. Appreciate your time.
All right.
There's a couple other items I want to bring to the committee's attention. I have an amendment to only restrict public members to current commercial fishers, not one person who has been a commercial fisherman. So I can see some rationale for a person just to keep the conflicts down. But if a person, a commercial fisherman, an active commercial fisherman, but if he's a commercial fisherman in the past, there's no reason to not let him serve on the board. So, and the same way goes with the other side of the coin. And then we also have an amendment to delete the waiver for the Kenai River Special Management Area, and that waiver is in existing statute. And if Senate Bill 24 passes, it would not be necessary. But we'll take care of that later. And with that, I'm going to hold this bill, set it aside, do some more work on it. And thank you, Mr. Pawlowski, and thank you, Lisa. Okay, Mr. Sullivan.
Commissioner, okay.
Next person we'll hear from is Commissioner Sullivan today. There was an item distributed by the commissioner earlier. We'll check, make sure everybody has it. And just a briefing note, talked about a million barrels a day within 10 years. And Commissioner Sullivan just wanted you to have this. He's starting to work on this. I should note he and I were discussing it, and one of the things came up that got left out of here was the Umiat oil production when it comes on. So he'll be adding that to this. So this right now is a work in progress. So he'll be updating it and then redistributing it again. Did you get one?
No, I don't.
Senator?
Yeah, I don't.
I'll get another one. So I'll get that. Oh, here we go. So with that, Mr. Sullivan's here. He also has with him Bill Barron and Brent Goodrum, Director of Mining, Land and Water, and Gene Davis, the Director of Sports Services. And there may be lots of people online to answer questions needed. And in Fairbanks, there will be Chris Masich, Director of Forestry, Masich, and Bob Swenson, Director of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Ben Ellis will be in Anchorage. Ben's the Director of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. And with that, I'll turn this over to Commissioner Sullivan, and welcome.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Pleasure to be back. I want to just start out by mentioning that a top priority for me and the team at DNR is to have a strong, respectful, and responsive relationship with the legislature, particularly the committees of jurisdiction. And I think that we certainly, as the governor said in the State of the State, that a lot of agreement on the goals, maybe not always agreement on the means, but what I certainly am trying to encourage with my team is timely, responsive information to help you do your jobs and us to do our jobs. We did get letters into Senator Pascavan and Senator Wolakowski here at the buzzer. Took a while longer than I had anticipated, but so we want to do that. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, have a number of members of my team here, and last week we actually had the opportunity to testify in front of House Resources and started that testimony with everybody, all the directors from all of DNR here, and that was really important, kind of a symbol of what we want to try and do with the legislature. So if you don't feel you're getting that kind of responsiveness anytime during the session, please let me know. But it is one thing, and I'll go through it quickly here, but it's certainly since the last legislative session that we've added a couple new directors, and I think we've put together a really strong team, and hopefully you're getting the opportunity to meet with all of them. Certainly Bill Barron, Brent Goodrum are two additions since the last session, those two and a bunch of others are doing great work for the state. So what I wanted to do this afternoon, again, I appreciate the invitation to come testify, was to just give a little sense of reintroducing the team, but most importantly, kind of an overview of some of the strategies, activities, and results that we have focused on really since the end of the last legislative session. So we have a PowerPoint here that I'll try and plow through rather quickly, but really looking forward to having this more of a conversation. So if there's questions through the presentation, it's fine with me to kind of just jump in and ask questions or any way that you want to do it, Mr. Chairman, is fine with me. Just kind of an overview of where we've been and where we think we're going, and that would be an appropriate way to start the legislative session.
That would be good, but I want some emphasis placed on where we're at in the permitting process as far as cleaning up our backlog of permits, and I want a good, strong report on that.
You will get it, Mr. Chairman, and it's, I think it's a good report. So without any further delay, I'll just start through here. As I mentioned, kind of an overview, looking back, and some opportunities and challenges. And as you mentioned, we also left with you a draft paper right now that focuses on the issue of a million barrels a day, some of our kind of thinking that went into that, something we worked on quite a while, kind of an outline roadmap, certainly not a easy goal, but why we think it's achievable, but some of the things that have to come together. And we thought that I just wanted to provide that here because I know there's been a lot of discussions in the hallways on this issue, and we thought we could provide you our thinking on it. So I think these are pretty basic issues here. One thing we did do, and actually it's got a little press coverage, so I'll be glad to talk about it here. Over the last year, we did try to focus our mission statement more in line with the Article 8, Section 1. And then the core services that you see on the right-hand side of this slide, we really revamped those more to kind of give what we thought was a much more accurate overview of what DNR actually does. There, these numbers, again, are pretty well known to this committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me. Senator Stevens.
Just a question, Commissioner. The mission statement is different than it was. I read quickly the story in the paper.
Yeah.
The mission statement is different than it once was, and how is it different?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, what I was focused on, a couple things. When I looked at the policy statement in the Constitution, I just thought it was very important from the perspective of the directive in the Constitution to have our mission statement aligned with that. So that, in some ways, was the key focus. I will tell you that there was another issue from an internal management perspective, as you can imagine, focusing on providing a mission that the department gets behind. One of the things early on last year that I was a little bit surprised of when I was undertaking what I referred to as kind of the DNR engagement tour after I was appointed to the position. I got out to a number of different communities throughout the state and was surprised to hear that in a number of areas, one of the views of DNR was that they were very focused on kind of, you know, the Department of No, locking up resources, not allowing access. This is a common theme I heard certainly in Fairbanks, and wanted to make sure that, you know, at least within the department, that people realize, you know, knew that this land was the land of the Alaska people, not the land of DNR. And I think that that focus on the mission also helped focus that issue. It's a discussion I've been having with a lot of our leadership within DNR. And then, you know, the question came up last week, that does that mean we're still not focused on future generations and conservation? Absolutely not. It's something that is a huge part of the DNR work. Parks, for example, that's essentially what they do. So the focus, and I thought it was important, was to make the alignment much more closely aligned with the directive in the Constitution. And so that's what we've done. Now, it came out in the House Resources that, and to be honest, I didn't know this. This is actually a role that the legislature has in statute that they can and have in the past written the missions for the different agencies and promulgated them.
Yeah.
But also, just to be clear, check with the Department of Law that, you know, it's also, from their perspective, okay to have the commissioners and the executive branch rework it, but certainly if there's a desire for the legislature to work this or want to issue a new mission statement, I think that's your prerogative. So probably longer longer answer than you anticipated, but
Senator Steve,
I've been asked about this a lot.
I appreciate it, Commissioner, and apparently you've thought about it and looked into it. All I can tell you is, as Senate President, I've had a couple of senators say, hey, wait a minute, that's our job. It may not be, so if you have some legal explanation of that, I'd appreciate just receiving it.
Actually, I think that through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think that there's statutory provision that says you certainly have the authority to do just that, to issue it. But in the absence that, you know, it doesn't preclude, at least my discussions with the Department of Law, it doesn't preclude commissioners from doing it. But if there's an interest from the legislature, we're ready to fully engage on it.
Senator Pasquin?
Just kind of following up on that, do you know whether a prior legislature had enacted the mission statement?
So through the chair, Senator Pasquin, I think the last time the legislature issued different agency mission statements, I believe I can get back to, I think it was 2003. And since that time, at least I know the DNR mission statement has changed a few times. You know, it's kind of on the margins, whether the term within the public interest is there, whether it includes future and present Alaskans. So I think that was the last time that the legislature, at least for DNR, promulgated a mission statement.
Senator Pasquin?
In part, what I believe Senate President Stevens is indicating is that if there was a legal analysis of this, you know, I think that he's sure. indicating he would like to see that, because I don't know whether a prior legislature had enacted that, but if it's had and there's a legal analysis of that, that's what I think is being requested.
Sure. I think we can certainly provide you with what what I was told by the Department of Law. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it arose last week and I was unaware of the legislative mandate in this area.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Stevens.
We're very prickly about our responsibilities. and I think it would just be interesting to see the comparison, maybe in writing, between the old mission statement and the new mission, what it really means. I have no objection to this at all. I'd like to see what the change is all about.
To be honest, had I known what I was stepping into, I probably wouldn't have stepped. I'm trying to just certainly recognize the prerogative of the legislature in this area. And
Mr. Commissioner, our plate's very full. Please just go ahead and proceed with your presentation now.
Quickly, yes.
So the next couple slides are really just the team that I've mentioned, and like I said, they all were here last week. A number of them were here this week. And again, if you have specific questions for some of the key members, be glad to make sure that they're able to answer some of those questions today. So you've seen this slide before, Mr. Chairman, but this, I think, is important. It's what the state manages and in different areas, but we all know that these estimates are very, very large. Since the last legislative session, you had the USGS come out with new Cook Inlet estimates. That's reflected in that slide number 9. Again, I had shown, I think, this slide to the committee last year, but these give you a sense on slide 10 of the very significant mineral deposits if we were actually an independent country. So that's a little bit of an introduction. Really, the key of what I wanted to cover here was looking back on the year since the legislative session. I think what we've been referring to as a promising year. I think part of your materials should have a op-ed that I had an opportunity to write in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner on New Year's Day that kind of mentioned a number of these things. So try and walk through this relatively quickly. This slide, I think, is very familiar to everybody in this committee, but I do think what was important last year was that the government, the state government, was very, very focused on a vision and a strategy to address the TAP's throughput decline. So you saw in the governor's state of the state that this is really, from our perspective, the key economic issue facing the state. And what we have tried to do is lay out a vision of trying to address that. That's a million barrels a day, and as I mentioned, have more materials there for you on that. And then the strategy, and I can go through each one of those if you'd like, but I think the key thing from our perspective for this committee to take away is, you know, it's one thing to lay out a strategy and have it look nice and everything, but what we really focused on over the course of the last several months was working hard to implement every single one of these five parts of the strategy in different ways. And I can tell you that my team, well, everybody, not only the DNR team, but from the governor on down, was very relentlessly focused on implementing this strategy. Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll take a moment real quick. You look at section part two of this strategy. It's focused on permitting. And I do want to give some kudos to one of my colleagues here, Brent Goodrum. Brent is a retired Marine recon officer and infantry officer, but also has a lot of experience in systems management through the military, master's degree in that, and has really been leading the charge on permitting. And I can touch on some of the highlights, but what we've done since the last legislative session is first, with regard to the increment that we received from the legislature that was part of the governor's budget, we very significantly increased the number of people in the mining Division of Mining, Land, and Water. We've filled 31 of 36 vacancies. We've conducted new employee training for over 50 employees in that critical part of DNR. We have focused on a new IT system within Mining, Land, and Water, which was also part of the increment that we received, and Brent can go into a little bit more of that if you'd like. We've made about a 20% dent in the backlog, which, to be honest, I didn't think I'd be here a year later saying that we've made that much progress. So remember, there was that backlog of 2,500 permits. There's obviously a lot of permits still coming through, so it's kind of like, you know, repairing an airplane when it's in flight, and we've made significant progress on that. Additionally, we've been working on looking at an entire area of regs, potential statutory changes that we're still discussing with the governor's office on a package that we would work with through the legislature on other areas to get permitting efficiencies in terms of certainty, in terms of coordination. And I think we've made quite a lot of progress in this area. And to be honest, I thought it was a great area of bipartisan support. Last year during the legislative session, there seemed to be a lot of interest in this issue, both from a funding and personnel standpoint at DNR, and also in terms of different areas in which we have are going to make suggestions on making a more efficient permitting system. We've held public meetings throughout the state, probably in almost all of your different constituencies, to get input from different stakeholders. And in addition to that, we've been focused on coordination between the state and the federal government, because that's a critical area. And then we've been anticipating and planning for permitting in next phases of resource development, such as shale oil, such as underground coal gasification, where the state has not really focused that on those areas before because they haven't been areas of development. So I can bring Brent up to give a lot more detail, but it's been an area that we've I think we've made a lot of progress on. So that's been the strategy, Mr. Chairman, and it's something that, again, I would welcome the chance to go into any kind of details. We see that there are signs that certainly the some of this is starting to bear fruit. You probably realize we're going to have quite a busy exploration season this winter and spring. You look at this slide 14, and it details some of that. Similarly, we had a lease sale on the North Slope that we actually pushed back to December. It was We thought a successful lease sale, we have on the slide 15, it's got a number of the companies. We really, really beat the pavement to try and get a lot of companies interested on this. There were some companies that we thought we were going to show, and at the last minute did not. But overall, you know, one of the things we really wanted was a very wide diversity of companies, big companies, super majors, small, nimble companies, and we think we did achieve that. It was great to see Shell picking up state acreage, Repsol picking up additional state acreage, Conoco picking up new exploration acreage, and so we saw that as successful, although, to be honest, I thought it was going to be more successful, talking to a number of companies who didn't show. And we're kind of doing our due diligence with them, saying, why didn't you? And I will tell you, some of them, it was, you know, tax-related on the cost issue.
Senator French.
Thank you. Can we go back one slide to the North Slope activity?
Yeah.
Because we kind of glossed over the exploration season that we're looking forward to this year. I imagine it's kicked off by now. It's January. Ice roads should be getting in. Do you know the status of any of those wells? Have they sputtered in? You know, where are we on that?
Yes, I'm Bill Barron, the Director of Oil and Gas, through the Chair of Senator French. Repsol has started their activities. Most of the ice roads and ice pads have been built. The season does look to be favorable, but from where we were 4 or 5 months ago, thinking that there was going to be one of the largest ever, typically that tends to wind back down, and we're looking at somewhere between 10 and 16 wells to be drilled this year, which, quite frankly, is around the normal average over the last 10 or 15 years. So it does still look like a good season, but it hasn't been played out as being as robust as we thought when we thought we were going to have 25 to 27.
And this is kind of the reality check that we were sort of looking to get from you as the season actually is upon us. Tell me this, what in your, my sense is that the slope right now is rig constricted. That's one of the problems. Is that your analysis as well?
Through the chair, Senator French, that is part of the problem. There's only so many rigs available, and with the limited time frame of winter only on ice roads and ice pads, that does begin to cause a bit of a bottleneck.
And Repsol, though, it sounds like Repsol is actually sticking to their plan. They had a five-rig exploration drilling program planned. It sounds like they're on track. How do you, is it because they're just a bigger, more sophisticated company that they're ahead of the smaller guys, or what's your analysis there?
Through the chair, Senator French, Repsol realized what the limitations were and were aggressive. And in fact, they have dropped one rig, and that rig is being picked up by Savant for some exploration work out of Badami.
So, through the chair, Senator French, so it's a four-rig program now.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks. I'll make an adjustment on my piece of paper about that. It's still a good drilling year. You know, last year I was at this table. Many of you were at that table. If I heard it once, I heard it a dozen times that it was a major, major problem that we're only having one exploration well. And I would hate to think of where we would be right now if there was only going to be one well or two wells or no wells drilled this year. So it's fantastic news that we're seeing a good, strong, if only average, over time exploration season. But I guess that sort of leads to a couple conclusions, which is there's only so much you can expect, right, realistically, on the North Slope, given the harsh conditions, given the expense, given the lack of infrastructure, and so forth. You know, we could say we're going to have 25 wells next year, but chances are 10 of those are going to fall through. You tell me what's the practical limit of the North Slope for drilling exploration wells, you know, realistically in the next 5 years?
Through the chair, Senator French, while there is a great deal of very found truth in what you're saying, given the current operating conditions on the slope, it wouldn't take much for some of those operating conditions to change. Anything that we can do as a state to, for example, roads to resources, to extend permanent roads into areas that would then minimize the need for the length of some of the ice roads would be an advantage. Based on if we assume failure, which is typically what we do in an exploration season because of ice roads and ice pads, you're expecting a dry hole. If, on the other hand, we had robust success from Repsol and the Great Bear activity, which will be later, there will be a market-driven exercise to get more rigs up here. I mean, the industry will respond if there's that kind of success.
You know, Brad, through the chair, Senator French, that's one thing I wanted to add. In discussions with pretty much all of these companies, that was one thing that what Bill just mentioned, where the planning in terms of if there is a continued interest, the planning in terms of getting additional rigs up here does not necessarily limit us to this number. There could be, with the proper planning, a lot more rigs.
And that's exciting news. But I'm glad you mentioned Great Bear, because they're a good example of what can be done in the summertime now. Great Bear can drill summertime wells. They don't need ice roads. They don't need ice pads. They're going to be operating, my understanding, is along more or less the pipeline corridor, where you just pull off the haul road and set up on a pad that may be already in existence. So it's a kind of a low-cost startup. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator French, that's correct. Great Bear came in with a very interesting idea. And what they did is they looked at areas that had already been previously disturbed. And rather than disturb new soils or new areas or new tundras, they thought we can position ourselves to be able to do a resource evaluation program on existing disturbed soils, which is a great idea.
Very clever. And
what that does is actually allowed the division to sign a waiver from the ice road ice pad stipulation in the best interest finding to accommodate that. So it's going to work out really well.
And I appreciate your flexibility on that point. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thinking you want to reward. That's the kind of quick decision-making we need on your behalf, so that they're not faced with a one-year sort of decision-making process to do something that's blindingly obvious, right? I mean, use an existing road and use an existing pad. That's fantastic.
Through the chair, that's correct. I appreciate that. A point of correction or clarification, the Great Bear wells that I referred to in my 10 to 16 are not included,
right?
Because they will be
they've been pushed out
out of the winter season.
So they're an annual total. So we may get 20 wells if they do four, and
we'll be up in a much more of a robust,
very very robust season. Last point on this, and I don't mean to dominate the conversation, but roads to resources. I'm glad the commissioner brought that up, because that to me is the kind of thing that Alaska can do with its oil wealth. To be a partner. I gave a speech yesterday on the floor about being a partner with the oil industry, and I think you guys are on the same page. I think we're all on the same page about that. But, you know, you think about, you know, just a simple decision between, say, lowering taxes, and you're not sure what you're going to get. I mean, I think we're all hopeful, but you're not sure. I don't think anyone's gotten any written promises about what sort of activity we'll get in exchange for a lower oil tax rate. Contrast that with a concrete proposal to spend, you know, take the governor. What's the governor's proposal? $90 million for a road to Umiat?
I don't know exactly what.
Somewhere, I mean, it's a big number, but it gets you out to a new basin. Double that, and really be bold and really drive some dirt across the North Slope, because you and I both know it's a dirt-strapped region, and it's a really expensive. High quality, high cost commodity, gravel on the North Slope. You wouldn't think that, but it's true, and it's a huge cost of doing business there. And you know, make the state investment in something as easy as a road, and see if that doesn't provoke a huge amount of drilling that you want to see and we all want to see. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my understanding is that there were some wells that were denied permits by some of the local communities on the North Slope. Is that
so? Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think I wouldn't call it denied. I think what you saw there was actually a pretty good collaboration effort between, in one particular case, Repsol, State of Alaska, the North Slope Borough, and the communities there. We all worked together for a number of weeks, actually, to get to what I think everybody agreed was a optimal number that got support from all those different stakeholders. So it was more of a consensus issue.
So if I could follow up. So were there five wells originally planned, and then that was knocked down to?
Five rigs,
I'm sorry.
Approximately three wells. approximately 15 wells from that, the five-rig program. Now it's a four-rig program.
And then were the number of wells decreased because of that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, the number of wells actually were then decreased because of that one rig was not able to drill the well and the sidetracks that had been originally planned. That, those have been deferred till next year.
And if I could just follow up, and was this, was that the North Slope Borough?
Through the chair, yes, sir, that's correct.
Was that, was that a process that would have gone through the Coastal Zone Management Program before?
Through the chair, Senator, yes, it would be.
Okay, and because we didn't have the Coastal Zone Management Program, you had it going through the local community, which had their own rules and regulations that they were now able to enact?
No. Through the chair, Senator, the issues and concerns that were brought forward by the communities and the borough would have been the same concerns and issues that they would have brought forward through the Coastal Zone Management Act. In light of the fact that that tool we no longer had in our toolbox, what that required the division and Fish and Game and other and DEC and the local community, what that required us to do was begin to actually engage in a much more healthy and direct dialogue rather than being, here's your check boxes, this is what we're going to have to do. We actually had to really much more thoroughly engage in one-on-one discussion and dialogue, which actually turned out to be very healthy. Yeah.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, Bill Barron mentioned, I think that it was turned out to be a very healthy dialogue. I mean, it was a lot of engagement from different key stakeholders on important issues, and I thought it ended up working out well.
Although we have less rigs and less wells being drilled now, correct?
Well, if you're implying, through the chair, if you're implying that had we had Coastal Zone Management, we would have had more wells, I actually think that's the wrong. I don't think that's the correct conclusion. We wouldn't have. These were the concerns that would have been raised through the, you know, the borough has its own regulations and permitting processes that it goes through, and what we were doing was coordinating closely with them. As they were doing it, as we were doing it, we were all sitting at the table together. So I'm sure the concerns would have come forth regardless of under what process it was.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the interesting point that you bring up, ironically, though, because of that one rig being removed from Repsol's program, that actually gave Savant, a smaller player, an opportunity to drill this winter. So we will now actually have a exploration program in an area that we would not have had prior to this.
So I'll just continue on. As I mentioned, thanks, Bill.
If I can,
maybe you might want to just stay up here.
It's nice to have a
friend. It's going fine.
Nice to have a friend of the team.
I'm going to call Brent Goodrum up here soon, too. But if that's okay, Mr. Chairman, you're seeing
it. Senator Pastown.
You know, in more of a global context of, as I understand, you indicated that your backlog of permits was caught up approximately 20%, you know, so which is very much applaud the hard work within the entire department to do that. Is there any permitting application that for a significant activity on the North Slope that is being held up by permitting activity?
Through the chair, I think the answer is no. And one of the things that we did, and I'm very proud of the team here, you know, we had a very, very busy November, December, because of the lease sale, because of all the permitting requirements for a fairly busy exploration season. And we had some big deals closing in the Cook Inlet also. Our team worked kind of around the clock to make sure that happened. So I'm pretty sure that the answer to that is no, but maybe I should check. Is that right?
I don't know.
I don't know of any. But it was I can tell you, it was a Herculean effort by these guys and other guys within the state government.
Senator Wilikowski.
Just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In other words, I think the public should hear that you know, there's nothing on a permitting basis right now that is inhibiting, you know, activities up on the North Slope in the sense of this, you know, in the sense of
you're talking current state government.
In other words, government. What I'm talking about, your department.
That's correct.
Okay, that's what I just think that the public needs to know that.
Senator Wilkowski. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have said this, I may have missed it. How many permits are backlogged? And then just following up on Senator Patsvan's question, has there been any delay in any development in the state because of the permit backlogs?
So, through the chair, I'd actually like, just for the committee's benefit, to ask Brent Goodrum to come up and address that. But I think it's good to hear directly from the guy who, for this committee, the guy who's driving this. I'll just give you, with a backlog like this, Senator Wilkowski, I think there, in my view, I think there's somebody somewhere, some small business certainly, that's probably hurting because of this backlog. I would have no doubt about that. So, you know, one of the things that we've kind of had to do is triage, which isn't always good, based on kind of economic impact. But our goal is to just eradicate it, and because I think there's a fairness aspect here that if you've been waiting a long time just because it's a smaller project or permit, that's really not a good place to be for the state government. So I don't know, Brent, if you want to.
For the record, my name is Brent Goodrum. I'm the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. At the end of fiscal year 11, June 30th, we had about 2,658 permits or authorizations that were in a backlog status. That number had grown from the last legislative session because during that time we still had about 26 to 28 vacancies within our division. Once we had started hiring folks about 1 July, as the commissioner had mentioned, we have filled 31 of 36 vacancies that existed from that date. As of 30 December of this year, the total of permits or authorizations that are in a backlog status is 2,095, which is a decrease of 563 authorizations, or a decrease of 21%. And so there's been a rather robust effort on our department, our division's part, to tackle this very important problem.
Just real quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I appreciate what you're doing to try to get rid of that backlog. Just where are we seeing the backlog? I mean, who's hurting from the backlog?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I mean, there's various different types of authorizations. Over 600 of them are water-related. Permits are shorter in nature. They're somewhere around... I'll find the exact numbers. They're in the 200s as far as the number of authorizations. But as a whole, I mean, they're throughout the state, and we've worked to develop tools that give us better visibility on which ones are out there, and so we can prioritize efforts looking to provide the most benefit to the state. And as the commissioner mentioned, I mean, there is a sense of equity that we need to try and balance as well as far as the amount of time that someone's been waiting in the queue. But then as we get important new projects that come in, we need to seriously look at the impacts it has to the state and the economic future of the state. So we try and weigh a bunch of that all together as we try to eradicate this issue.
And through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, one additional point is, so we're not just trying to get this backlog down and then kind of, you know, then it grows again. We're trying to reform the system so you don't have you don't have it regrow, so you actually get in front of it. So what Brent's team has also been doing is looking at ways to ensure a more efficient process through technological changes, as I mentioned, kind of a systems approach, but also through either regs or maybe even, and we're still working on it, kind of suggested statutory changes where we're seeing statutes or regs that no longer make sense, or that kind of add an additional burden that we don't think is in the best interest of the state or people trying to develop resources here. So it's an ongoing process that has a number of different balls in the air, but the ultimate goal is to not only get rid of the backlog, but to reform the system in a way that you don't get back to another backlog once you've brought it down to zero. And I think we're off to a really good start, year one. So we appreciate the legislature's support on this because, like I said last year, from our perspective, it was a very good bipartisan support for this work.
Thank you. Senator Passavant?
You know, do you expect to see a 20% reduction continuing or 25%? In other words, if you were to have your crystal ball, you know what your process to get down that 500 and some permit backlog that you've caught up now. Kind of what do you see going forward so that, you know, again, so that the public can, that's listening can say, okay, you know, our DNR is on task. We're going to not only get our backlog caught up, but you're going to be on top of the new permits.
So through the chair, I'll let Brent kind of maybe answer a little more specificity. To be honest, I didn't think we'd be down this. I didn't think we'd make this much progress in year one simply because, you know, we only received the funding to start hiring and training the new members in June and working the new system. And he's been out, you know, meeting with different technology providers on the technology upgrades. So I would hope so, but maybe I'll let him answer.
Hence my question. In other words, I think 20% in 6 months is awesome. So kind of what do you see in the next 18 months or the next whatever time period it is that you are kind of your internal best judgment?
Through the chair, Senator Passavant, when the commissioner worked with the legislature last year, the three-year timeline that was initially set out was a very ambitious timeline, and we've worked hard. We've taken some good first steps in that direction. As we analyzed the backlog and began to work on it, there were some permits or authorizations that are going to be easier than others perhaps to initially attain. And I think we probably realized that in addition to, as we've been processing those, you know, we've gone through the process of hiring folks and training folks and identifying the other capabilities that we need to be successful and the tools we need to provide to our personnel so we can help develop a culture of better understanding our processes so we can develop a continuous process improvement system. And so I would say that to hit 20% at this point was great by a lot of the hardworking folks in the division. I don't know that I can anticipate and draw a straight line out and say a year from now that we're at 40%, because a lot of those other authorizations, some of them are going to be more complex. But our goal is to address this within the three-year time frame that the commissioner agreed to last session.
So we'll get there.
Thank you.
So the other, what we thought was positive news from 2011, and you know maybe this should not be so triumphant here with the term renaissance, but maybe a mini renaissance. But clearly, there's a lot going on in Cook Inlet, and there's certainly the USGS report came out, but that upped the numbers significantly. We had one of our most successful lease sales in about 30 years. I do think that what's driving this is a competitive price, certainly, but also the very competitive tax and investment incentives in the inlet. You see some pretty significant new players, some world-class players, Apache, others, Hillcorp's a very well-respected company, a number, again, a whole kind of diversity of different players and a lot of new activity. You may have seen a Wall Street Journal article that kind of captured this. So we thought that that was another important element of what's happening in the state, in large part driven by, you know, policies that came from this committee, the investment incentives, the Stampede Act. And so I think that's a good example of things working. That last bullet, though, very important. you should be aware we were very, very, very vigilant with regard to all the new players. That's a, you know, in some ways a tricky reservoir, and we had a lot of people with some pretty vigilant oversight to make sure that, you know, you never want to jinx yourself, but to make sure that the activities were done in a safe manner. So the other area that we thought was positive for 2011 was a bit of a mining boomlet, or at least exploration boomlet going on, strategic and critical minerals in the state. The next slide, slide 19, if you look, the number there below the picture, I think, is a real impressive one. About one-third of all exploration investment in the United States took place in Alaska. And that's just not big projects that everybody knows about. If you look at that second-to-last bullet there, that's pretty broad-based in terms of 34 different exploration projects, over $1 million. And then even an interesting development, the offshore mineral leases in the Nome area also obtained a lot of interest and a significant amount of money for the state. Just gives you a quick overview of some of the activity in the mining sector. And then this, for those who had the opportunity, this is a agenda. This just gives you kind of a good sense of what the interest in the state. This was a summit that we put on in Fairbanks at the end of September called the Strategic and Critical Minerals Summit. The reason I mentioned this was when the governor laid out kind of the Secure Alaska's Future Strategic Minerals Plan that has a number of elements that we'd certainly be glad to brief the committee on. But what was very interesting, we for a lot of reasons, trying to get a number of the very high-level panelists, participants, industry folks from all over the country to come. Coordinating schedules, ended up we only had about 5 weeks to put this together. And yet it was a sold-out event. So we had to turn people away. And most, I would say at least half, were out-of-state people coming up to Alaska, investors, companies, CEOs, Japanese government officials, all came to Fairbanks. And if you talk to folks who were there, I think everybody would agree it was a very energized summit, a lot of focus on rare earth elements and other strategic minerals and the potential of the state. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask you that about rare earth minerals and the potential today versus last year at this time when we had a presentation on it. It seems to me like some of the information I've seen, there's an increase in areas where rare earth minerals must occur in the state of Alaska. So that has grown tremendously in the last year.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I think what's grown also is, I mean, one of the great things that came out of this summit was we had at least two Bloomberg, Reuters, really big, long, national financial newspapers covering this and talking about the potential in Alaska. You have this company, Ucore, that's looking at a rare earth mine, the Bokan Mountain down here in southeast. But as you probably know, Mr. Chairman, we're undertaking a three-year, again, part of the governor's budget request this year, but it was approved last year by the legislature to do a three-year assessment. We're coordinating now with the USGS. A three-year assessment of strategic and critical minerals of the entire state with a focus on rare earth elements. So that's a big deal. When you talk to companies, they think it's great because we're just going to make all that information public as we get it. So Bob Swenson, I think, is on the line. He's been leading that, doing a great job on that. And it's exciting. And had you been at this conference, you know, these lot sometimes it can be boring, and there was a real, real sense of excitement and opportunity at this summit. So that's kind of oil, gas, but of course DNR and minerals. DNR has other areas that we're responsible for. I think we had a good year with regard to agriculture. We're trying to continue to focus particularly on the Alaska, promoting the Alaska Grown program. the parks and outdoor recreation, you know, I think this is another area that's huge, hugely important, largest park system, state park system in the country. Ben Ellis has been doing a fantastic job there. All kinds of new initiatives. For anyone in Anchorage, this Friday, there's going to be this, you see the second bullet, we had our Arts in the Park initiative that got some of the state's best artists to come paint in the parks. They're going to display their great work, over 100 paintings at Blaine's Art, the art shop there in Anchorage. So, and then the boating safety program, which is getting national attention and, importantly, saving lives. And I don't think the state can do any more important work than that. And then with regard to Division of Forestry Timber Resources, one of the things I know that has been a huge frustration for the state has been the declining in the timber industry, particularly in Southeast. And again, with the legislature's help, we had a good year last year with regard to looking to double the size of the state forest for opportunities there. And the task force that the governor set up is also something that we think has made a lot of progress. This next slide is really what you didn't hear in the news, but we actually had a fire season. I know in certain areas of the state pay attention to this more than others, but if you look at that slide, that's actually a picture that was a fire near Fairbanks. You see how massive those fires are. But our guys did a fantastic job of fighting fires to make sure that in some ways this wasn't news. By the end, they actually went down to help the Texans because they were having such a horrendous firefighting season. And then I would just mention kind of, Mr. Chairman, one final issue. I think we saw a bit of a shift. It's not 100% there, but, you know, we had the federal government kind of moving, I think, more in line on some issues with regard to resource development in the state. But as I've mentioned, it's kind of a two-step forward, one-step back process with them. We have been having some issues with regard to the Point Thompson EIS. It's already been delayed a year, and some a sense from Fish and Wildlife that they might try to bootstrap some of the ANWR values into state land, which we would oppose vigorously, and we're having frank conversations with them about what we see as significant overreach in that part of the state.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any idea how many federal permits are being delayed or backlogged?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, no, but I certainly can get back to you. I mean, obviously, the Shell issue, the CD5 issue, Point Thompson issue, I mean, these are all things that have been delayed and delayed and delayed. So I know the list is longer than that, a lot longer than that. We can get back to that.
Senator Pasavan?
Just to follow up, you know, the lease sale this last fall, the coordination, how what was your sense of how that felt between the state and the federal government?
Through the chair, Senator Pasavan, I thought it went great. And look, I have no problems, or maybe it's also from my AG time, you know, where when we tangle with the federal government when we think that they're not acting in the state's interest. But you know, on the rare earth issue, I think we've gotten very good cooperation from them. And on the lease sale, we got great cooperation. The idea was to hold the lease sale, MPRA and state lease sale, the same day so companies could come and think more strategically about the North Slope. And we worked really well with the federal government there to do that. And I think it had a decent effect, right? You had some companies that were bidding on both sides of the state and federal border. And so I think it had an intended effect. And from our perspective, it would be great to do that again if they're planning on holding annual NPRA lease sales, to do it when we're doing it.
I just agree with you on that. It would be great to have that coordination between the federal and the state government.
Yeah, no, we'll continue to work that. So, so that's kind of an overview of the last year. And I think, but certainly, as this committee knows, we have significant challenges ahead of us. We think that, but there's a lot of good things to build on. The TAPS throughput issue remains the urgent issue from our perspective, the cornerstone. We believe the five-part strategy is meaningful tax reform, and we certainly want to work with the legislature on that. There's been a lot of what we think positive progress on commercializing North Slope gas. This is a, you know, again, over the course of the year, the governor has led kind of the effort to shift at least the focus. This is actually a couple slides that I used when I was briefing some potential interested government officials in different markets overseas, Japan, China, and you see there, I think, from our perspective, our Alaska natural gas LNG potential has significant comparative advantages to many other places in the world. That one issue that I kept hearing when I've met with these about the diversification for these countries and, you know, stable political and legal climate from another source that has been exporting LNG for 40 years already to Asia is something that I think a lot of attraction. We're closer than the Gulf states, that's for sure, and closer than Qatar, as a matter of fact, a lot of these countries. And then you saw in the governor's State of the State speech what he laid out as a roadmap in the state's interest. You see there, this is something I've briefed to this committee before, kind of key principles of any gas project. And so we think that there's a lot of progress there. And I guess I would just end with a slide that talks about something that we pretty much do every day at DNR, which is striking the balance between resource development, responsible resource development, being good stewards of the environment. And it's, I think, embedded in what we do. Sometimes it's in big decisions. Other times it's just daily calls that we make as the different team members at DNR carry out their responsibilities. So I think that's my last slide. So that's an overview, and we'd welcome any questions or comments or criticisms.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw it reported that you changed your mission statement.
Yeah.
And took out the word conserve, and any practical impact of the new mission statement? Was there some pressing need to change that? Or
so through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, what I was really focused on was what I thought was important was to align the mission statement with the policy statement in the Alaska Constitution. But as I testified, so that's what we did. And but as I testified last week, with regard to conservation, you know, we see the issues of conservation, public future use by Alaskans, certainly encompassed by the term within the public interest, responsible development. So as I mentioned earlier, we have entire divisions that are focused on conservation and like parks and, heck, a lot of what we do in other divisions. So that'll be a continued focus.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair, thank you, Commissioner. Couple questions that I have for you. The first was, as we've been giving speeches to the chamber, the Power Association, and things like that, we've been looking at the forecast, the revenue forecast into the future, and talking with groups about how many barrels of oil we'd actually have to produce to keep up with at the price, current prices today, to keep up with our current budget. And one of the figures in there is shows us that we'd need 180,000 barrels by 2016. And I guess my question for you is, are you aware of permits that have been requested that you think will achieve that goal or plans that you've seen? I'm just curious where we are in terms of achieving that goal.
So through the chair, Senator McGuire, I am not. So in terms, as you know, we're at about a 6% decline right now. That might even be understating it. And while the exploration season is positive, even if, let's say, Repsol finds a huge reserve of oil, the ability to get that online because of all the challenges and costs that we have is going to take quite, it'll take some time. It'll take more time than by 2016, most likely. So if there's going to be a significant bump in terms of those numbers that would offset, remember 6% at about 600,000, I think it's about 36,000 barrels a year declining, it's going to take a lot. So I am not aware of, and maybe I can ask Bill, but I'm not aware of developments that by 2016 would actually even have us holding the line at 600,000. Unless I think the most important way to try and hold the line is would be more infill drilling at the big legacy fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's what I thought you'd say, but I wanted it on the record for the committee and for the public to hear that when you do look at that forecast, that that indeed is what we're planning. And so it's incumbent on us as lawmakers to look at what we can do to change that dynamic. And I agree with you. I don't think anything we do today would change it by 2016, but at a minimum to try to stall the inevitable. My final point I want to make, it's really more of a point, and then I'd love a response from you. Near as I can tell, I think the issue that has come about with respect to the ACEs debate, for me, spending time in the interim, having time to talk with people from all walks of life in my district and other parts of the state, I think people in Alaska generally want to see Alaska remain competitive in terms of its oil and gas investments. So by and large, I mean, I assume there are people out there that just say no to oil and gas development. I have not met them. So the people that I meet say, yep, we want to stay competitive. But what they don't know and understand is where in the continuum, as you tweak the current tax system that we have, is it incumbent on us to change it in favor of the oil companies to give us that competitive advantage? And I think what people have said to me is, Liesl, isn't there a way that you can somehow, you know, link that benefit to guaranteed production? And what I say is no. I mean, it reminds me of the cruise ship head tax debate. You know, it was $50 set by the initiative, and we were discussing moving it down to $35 or something around that figure as negotiated by the governor. But the question that kept coming up over and over again, Senator Wilikowski and others said, what guarantee will we have that we'll have new cruise ships coming in and that infiltration into the economy? I don't think you can in a capitalistic economy guarantee that. So I guess what I want to say to you is that we need help. I think you do have a Senate that for those members that weren't convinced before that's coming around. I sense that, having been here 12 years, I sort of know when an issue moves over to the edge, and it's there. But we need the data. We need your help to explain it to the public, and I think also to really better articulate what it is about the formula that's wrong, because there's a base rate and then there's the progressivity element. And trying to understand how that every dollar compounds into the 0.4 percent tax and why that ends up feeling or acting punitive in terms of an economic model is something that is very complex to explain. You've spent time with these companies. I have too. And I try my best to explain that in a high-priced oil environment, you've got money to play with, and you do have CapEx opportunities. And so folks are looking around and saying, well, where do we want to invest? And they're going to look for the biggest bang for the buck. But there needs to be a way to synthesize that down and I think really explain the model in a way that we can sell to the public. And I think finally to synthesize this, and I guess the last point I'd make is I look forward to dialogue between you and the co-chairman of finance on decoupling, because I think we all understand, you know, that's the giant elephant in the room. You know, there was a veto of that and a difference of opinion on that, but you had the majority of the Senate members believing that decoupling was the right way to go, that they are two separate systems, and it was presented to us as a 6-to-1 ratio, you know, from time immemorial, and then we had the discovery of shale, which clearly put that way off the charts. And so I think we now know, at a minimum, those two systems ought to be separated. What we choose to do with gas tax may be one or the other, but I'd like to hear assurances that you're going to work with the co-chairman of finance on it, because it's the only way we're going to get to a solution.
Well, through the chair, Senator McGuire, I think, you know, kind of keeping in the spirit of kind of what we've seen or over the past year, I think I'll just make a few comments on the tax issue. You know, there's no doubt, and this is a combination of working with the team here, but also getting out and meeting with literally dozens of different groups and discussions. The great news is there's no doubt that we still sit on a world-class hydrocarbon basin on the North Slope. You include conventional, state, federal. But if you start to look at unconventionals, and by the way, USGS is starting to look at doing an unconventional study up there, we think the numbers are going to be off the charts.
Yeah.
And everybody that we've met with, that I've met with, that my team has met with, that recognizes that and says that. So nobody says, hey, the North Slope's a washed-up basin. We're not there because we don't think there's any oil. They all say that there's a ton of oil, and that's not even the issue, finding oil. But the issue is, and I think this is the critical issue that we need to think about as Alaskans, a lot of people think we're at a sustained high price phase in terms of oil prices, which I think would be good for the state, but for global reasons that they think that that's the case. But the disturbing thing from our perspective is that oil production is booming everywhere. It is booming everywhere, and that is a fact.
Yes.
It's booming in Texas. It's booming in North Dakota. I'm originally from Ohio. It's starting to boom in Ohio, and I'm like, damn, I didn't even know we had oil in Ohio. I mean, and it's booming in other countries, and it's not booming in the great hydrocarbon basin of North America.
That's right.
Why? It's a hugely important question. And it has to do with costs. There's no doubt about it. It has to do with costs. In the state of Alaska, development on the North Slope, we're saddled with certain costs that we're never going to get rid of. Remoteness, extreme Arctic climate and environment. You know, you talk to these companies, an exploration well up here versus one in North Dakota, holy cow, it's like 7 times the difference. So these are costs that we have to deal with. And so how can we address these costs? There's certain things that we can't do, but there's certain things, roads to resources, you know, that are certainly part of the governor's strategy that we can do. But what I hear, and I heard it across the board from companies that were looking to come here, companies are even coming, companies, you know, even Repsol said, hey, we're here for exploration, but we're not promising any development because of the high taxes. And where I heard it mostly was focused on the marginal tax rate on the higher prices.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say every company I ever met with, but I certainly pitched certain companies and they told me straight up, we're not looking at Alaska until you guys change your tax rate. Yeah. And I don't think they're, you know, changing talking points. So this is just the assessment that I had over the course of the last year, really trying to get out, understand, pitch the state. We were pitching the state to anybody who would listen, and we got in front of a lot of different people, a lot of different investors. I do think the cruise ship episode is a good analogy, because it wasn't a sure deal. I was very involved in that when I was Attorney General, but it sure looks like now that we're getting the return in terms of the ships coming back, that essentially these companies, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but that these companies mentioned that they were interested in doing if they had a more favorable mm-hmm. climate. And so, and with regard to your last question, you know, the governor addressed the issue of the decoupling during his press conference. I think his concern was not having to work through that twice, given that if there's going to be, let's assume that his roadmap, there's progress on that, and he mentioned that if there's progress and these benchmarks are met, that the legislative session next in 2013 would possibly take up those gas fiscals. But I don't think he, at least from, and I've only talked to him, I haven't talked to him about it, I just saw his comments in the press conference. I don't think he said, you know, no to that. I think that, I don't know where that is exactly right now.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman, did you have a question?
It backs up a little bit on the, I'm not quite sure on the policy statement of the departments, how that interties with the legislature on changing them.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that the legislature set some of that stuff, but I may be wrong because we don't deal with it very often. So I thought at some point we should check that to make sure that we understand the responsibilities of the legislature versus the executive branch in setting those policies.
Senator Pascan.
Thank you, Commissioner. In discussions that I've had with people as far as development on the Central North Slope, I've heard a Section 404. It's either a federal law or a permit. What application does that have, if at all, in the North Slope region? And does it exist, and what is it about? That's kind of off topic, but just...
Through the chair, Senator Pascan, it's a very important question because it's the... the wetlands kind of clean water related issue that in many ways provides a federal hook into all kinds of different activities, even in state land. So if you have a federal government that's not being cooperative, for example, until recently on the CD5 issue, or even other areas on state land, it's an issue that's it's a pretty important issue. And I think that as we've looked at some of the developments, I think it depends on where they are in on the North Slope, on what the applicability of the Section 404 issues are. But it's really important.
Follow-up, Senator Pascan.
Yeah, and I agree. It's what I'm trying to figure out is what has been the experience. In other words, not an NPRA, but in the Central North Slope itself, you know, the Alaska land itself, what has been the experience in the 404 process as far as developments? And I guess more focused, is that going to be an issue with shale oil extraction?
Again, Bill Barron, Director of Oil and Gas, through the chair. Senator, 404 for shale, I think undoubtedly will be an issue. The acreage that was secured by Great Bear in last year's lease sale, 500,000 acres, most of that will be in one way, shape, or form involved in a 404 determination. It could have a significant impact.
Is there any history in comparable lands in the Central North Slope with respect to how we've dealt with the 404 issue in Alaska?
Through the chair, almost all of the developments, to my knowledge, in the greater North Slope have had one way form or another a 404 determination, and the companies have over time understood what those time constraints are and plan accordingly. That being said, in reference to Senator McGuire's question, that is part and parcel of some of the problems in the delays of future development work is the federal permitting associated with wetlands and their primacy in it.
Follow up.
Yeah, I guess this is not a new application in the Central North Slope. This is just a standard business application for decades on the Central North Slope.
Through the chair, that's my understanding, yes, sir. And Cook Inlet.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator French?
I'll hold mine. It's kind of late in the day.
Don't hold it too long.
That's all we...
I thought it came out. With that, we're going to gavel out, so this meeting's adjourned. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.